Welcome to the Supported Living Property Podcast with your host, me, Lisa Brown, the place to learn about supported living property investing. This is one episode of a series of Lisa Live interviews that were recorded via Zoom and streamed into the Supported Living Property Investing with a Difference Facebook group. It was not studio recorded, and so please accept the sound quality as it is.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us tonight. And tonight we have Rich Liddell joining us for tonight's Lisa Live. We'll use the normal format that we normally do, where we have a bit of a chat about the things we're going to talk about, and then we'll open up for questions later. So if you've got any questions, please drop them in the comments box below. Rich, loads of people know you, I know, but for those who don't know you, do you want to introduce yourself a little bit?
Yeah, certainly. So I'm obviously Rich Liddell. I live up in York. A lot of people will have potentially seen me either in this group or in Blue Oak. So I'm one of the three that started Blue Oak along with Paul and Andy. We set that up last year as really, as it says on the tin, open, honest and ethical group. So that's where people potentially have seen me. Property-wise, I've been around in the property space for about 15 years. So back in 2003, the classic, it wasn't an accidental landlord, shall we say. I was, in fact, I'll come on to that story in a moment, but I've spent the past 20 years as well in the military, just shy of 22 years. I retired this year as a helicopter pilot, majority of my time, and then a fast jet pilot and a fast jet trainer for the latter part. So I was a military officer for the majority of that time. Started in property, as I said, back in 2003. And I wouldn't say it was an accidental landlord, I suppose, but it was more because we got upped and shipped to Iraq for the Iraq war in 2003. And we had no idea how long we were going for. So I just elected in a small village called Ilchester, which is by the Naval Air Station Yeovilton. And I was flying commando helicopters at the time. I just rented out my little two-bed cottage. I still own that property to this day. Still sat there in my portfolio. And really, it was on the back of that, I was sat on sailing around to Iraq, and every month I was getting this little sum of money drop into my bank account. And at that time, I thought, wow, this property game's quite good, isn't it? And it was really from there when I got home, I started taking a far more active interest in it, active interest in investments, and then really started to move into kind of HMOs up in Glasgow, HMOs in other parts of the country, then into smaller developments. So I've kind of got a smattering of properties around the country, pretty much wherever I used to be based, because in the military we moved every 2 years. I used to start a little portfolio. My last job, which is where I've just finished the military, was in just outside of York, where we taught basic fast jet flying. So all of the military fast jet pilots, whether they be Navy or Royal Air Force, used to come to this little air station. And we used to teach them how to fly. And I retired from that in March to go full time into running Blue Oak and into property and into the supported living sector. But for the past 15 years, I've juggled that alongside a full time military deployed career. And there's certainly been a few challenges, to say the least, in there. But it's been enjoyable. It's been enjoyable. I've thoroughly enjoyed them both. I never got into property with the intention of trying to get out my day job because I loved my day job. And the only reason I've now kind of given up that day job is because it was natural retirement age, which is really weird to say that at 40, 43 years old, I'm kind of retired and a pensioner as such. So, but that was it. I naturally retired. If I could still be in the military, I probably would.
Yeah,
but that's given me a huge passion, and we're going to talk about it tonight, in kind of that supported living, certainly with regards to the veterans. I've got a huge passion about the homelessness side and obviously into the supported living, but certainly the veterans and what goes on with them with regards to kind of how easy it is to quickly go, I wouldn't say off the rails, but it's a very easy thing for them to slip into. From a position of authority where they are potentially somebody of authority into a homeless situation. And then coupled with kind of PTSD for the past 10 years of Afghanistan, we're seeing a problem. And obviously that's very close to my heart. Mm. And that kind of sums me up, I suppose, in a wee bit. I've seen all of the strategies in property. I've been through a recession. I've seen everything there is to see, I would say. And this kind of now is my focus, running the Blue Wolf community, which I think is a fantastic place. You've worked with us in that community and then obviously into the supported living sector and then into the gateway piece, which you and I are working on.
Yeah, absolutely. So how did you get into supported living? How did that happen within that?
The first time I did it really was, it came about quite frankly because it was I had a property which was an HMO and it was LHA tenants. Not initially, the property had a smattering of kind of profession. This was before, we're rolling back to kind of 2007-08 at the time where they weren't as professional, say, in HMO as they are now. They weren't as licensed, they weren't as regulated. God, you used to, these were up in Glasgow and you used to just, fire up a stud wall, fire in another door and you'd have a multi person property.
So you'd have lots of people in that HMO.
Yes. Sorry, I just got thrown off there.
It's all right.
On an LHA, so they would be LHA. So we worked with the local council and it was a local housing authority rate. And what I realised actually is we saw a huge throughput of these tenants. And we were seeing from people who were kind of leaving university who were trying to work, but also to the homeless. And I had multiple HMOs in that region. And it was that made me initially think there's got to be an easier way of doing this, an easier way of me claiming the money, LHA from the councils. And that's where I started to look for the kind of the intermediary. Now would look at, the RP piece, but it was kind of an intermediary. The majority of people then were charities. So I approached a charity who would then subsequently take the building from me. And that was really the start of it.
You had that idea to try and find someone to act as that intermediary, or did someone approach you, or
how did that come about? I had that idea initially up there. Now, and that was simply because I had a few problems. I was juggling the council, the LHA payments, and I was juggling them myself, and it seemed to be an awful lot of work. Okay, so I thought there's got to be an intermediary. Mm. I kind of had this idea, but then I started to put the feelers out to see who was doing it and what was going on. And that kind of brought in this intermediary piece. So that was kind of my introduction, shall we say, into it. And it's one of those things that I didn't really do it on a focused, shall we say, intentional manner until probably 2012, 13, where at that point I was thinking, right, there's actually got to be a cleverer way to run some of my properties, a cleverer way to run some of my HMOs. And that's when I started to reach out to people, look at other people who were operating in this sector, speak to charities. I got very heavily involved with a charity in King's Lynn who was working, again, this was all working homeless, LHA, that kind of sector. And she was really groundbreaking in what she was doing. At the time, she ran a charity who was helping the homeless. And it all snowballed from there. And from there, it's gone into kind of care leavers, your kind of 16 to 24s, and then into the learning disabilities. But the piece with the homeless really started to resonate. And as I said, still have a property now, which I was on that. And the reason it started to resonate is I started to, again, look at, and this property's in Selby, so south of York, if anybody knows the region. And that's currently a move-on property, okay? So people who are coming off the streets, out of prison, but can't hold up their own tenancy. And what I started to learn is a very good friend of mine was an assistant director within the health service in the prison force, so the health side of the prison force. And he gave me some stats, and it was 74% of prisoners, 74% of prisoners will only be in prison for up to a year, okay? And out of that 74, I've written it down here, 46% of those will be back in within 12 months, okay? So there's a high cycle. But the thing that struck me was that from that, there was a direct correlation between health, between care, okay? So from there, they were all care leavers, between their physical health, their care, and the quality of accommodation to whether they reoffended, okay? So actually I thought, that's where you then look at the care sector as well, okay, so move that aside. But what I thought was actually quality of accommodation and health. Those two things coupled together can have a direct influence on that 46% of the 76% going back into prison.
Wow. So the direct correlation between the quality of the accommodation they're living in and the support they're getting, reducing the offending rate.
Yeah. So it was health. The three things they looked at were health, quality of accommodation, and then the support. And it was interesting when they looked at the support. A lot of it was to do with the speech therapy and being able to kind of get your emotions across. I can 100% understand. So when I looked at this study from Stephen, and I looked at it and I thought, do you know what, I can see that, because the amount of people I've had who have no ability to communicate because they've been in and out of care, they've been in and out of prison, they've been in on and off the streets. So actually it's this vicious cycle. And that was me then thinking, I can now directly help that sector. So I've got that property, which is what's called Move On. And then I've got another large property, which is the next stage for that.
Tell me about the Move On property, Rich. What sort of size property is it? How is it configured?
Yeah, so that's configured as three self-contained flats and then seven rooms above it. So it's one large building, three self-contained flats and seven rooms above it. And the idea behind that is that they will take that property on from me on a lease. Now, I work very closely with the housing options department of the local council. And then the idea being is they will sublet the rooms to the individuals on their own kind of tenancy. Right. Now, they run a program which teaches them how to be a good tenant as well, so which is a fantastic thing. So it's teaching individuals how to be, because again, we take it for granted, you know, that paying your bills, you know, topping up a card meter if you are on electric. And so all of the rooms have individual electric meters for that. And it's kind of that support of how to be a tenant, because people don't know. And again, it's one of those things that I took for granted, because it's what I would consider common sense, but that's assumed knowledge. And of course, that assumption is what can get people into trouble. And so the idea is that they will then give them this program of how to be a tenant. And it includes things like shopping, budget management, et cetera. And now obviously, and then as long as they uphold that tenancy, they can then move into kind of the next stage of accommodation. And then ultimately they move on to one other stage. And then beyond that, they would hopefully have their own tenancies in a self-contained unit, whether that be a flat or whether that be a small house.
So they move from those shared rooms down to the flats, or do they?
So that's the intent. Okay. So that's obviously in an ideal world. Quite often the people in the flats, you know, the flow hasn't necessarily worked. Mm-hmm. And of course that does prove a bottleneck, because, you know, you've got seven going into three. So then obviously some people will have to move elsewhere. And the trouble is with the local authorities here, you can move, the local authority covers in Yorkshire, the local authorities are huge. So actually that individual can move, say, from Selby all the way out somewhere else to, say, East Riding, where it's still in potentially the same council bubble, but it becomes, and that causes its own problems as well because of travel, you know, all sorts of people are trying to get into work. But it's fascinating when you look at, as I say, that stat really baffled me. Oh, not baffled me, really shocked me, I guess, with that the majority are in for a short period of time. So we all know that kind of the rehabilitation of prisoners thing has been kind of flawed for years, and I'm not the expert on that, but what it was, the stats that said a direct correlation between health, you know, the standard of accommodation and the care, because again the majority of these people are care leavers, and that obviously drew me back into the care side of things, which is why one of my other properties now is 16 to 24 year olds, where actually you're trying to capture people who potentially have had, you know, a really, I won't say a bad upbringing, but a disruptive one. You know, the potentially have been moved pillar to post. So actually, again, I'm looking, could I solve that? Not solve it, but could I help? I've got a property there. And of course, this led me to this exit, this strategy, and building this gateway of how can we do it on a larger scale? And obviously in your community, you've got some fantastic people who are doing it on a larger scale, certainly from the homeless side as well. You know, who are moving people through those Move On property. Fantastic. Absolutely admirable, the people who are doing that. And the more we can educate people on these strategies, the more we can help marry these property investors up with the RPs and the charities, then actually the more we can all help. And that was kind of the the thought process and where the gateway came from. If we can provide this matchmaking, this marrying service, it'll actually help the bigger society.
Yeah, absolutely. So your care leavers accommodation that you've got, what's that like, Rich?
Okay, so the care leavers accommodation is 7 individual one bed flats, one block, an entire block of 7 flats. So there's six are kind of leavers, one is an office space. The office space is a self-contained flat, but when they approached me for that building, they wanted the whole building. I didn't mind what they use that bottom one for. They use it as an office. Sometimes they do have 24-hour care there. And, so for instance, there was one of the... So that, again, is with them on a lease, but I do play quite an active role. So it's got a very... And the only reason I play an active role is there's about 1/2 acre worth of ground out the back, which was fenced off when I first developed this block of flats. It's got zero access to it, so I fenced that off, basically to stop them having to garden it, to stop them having to look after it. But every now and then I go and just clear it down. And when I do that, I'll go and have a chat, have a cup of tea, just re-engage with it, whoever's the care worker. So, and recently there was a young girl in there who was having a few more issues, shall we say, than somebody else. So that care worker was then there 24/7. And it's just interesting to see that flow. Sometimes they're there working hours. Sometimes, as I say, this RP will then provide 24/7 support should it be required. But yes, that's 7 individual one-bed flats.
Right. Did you go out to find someone? Did you think specifically, right, this is this property, I want to go and find someone to take it on? Or how did that come about?
Yeah, so that property is, that property was... my famous knotweed property, if anybody's ever heard that story before.
I've heard that story. Yeah, yeah. So, you want to share it, I'm sure everyone will want to hear it.
Yeah, it was a property that was a corporate sale, so it was a repossession. It was repossessed as the chap died. So it was in that, is this a probate, is this a repossession? It was kind of his estate was being sold, but it was being sold by the bank. It had been already converted to 7 one-bed flats, a large building, car parking, and I say a little piece of land out the rear. It had already been converted, and it was on for a guide of £100,000. And I remember looking up, doing a standard bit of due diligence initially, looking through the land registry, and you could see kind of open source information, clear as day, the chap paid £350,000 for it. He then subsequently did the conversion on it. So then you've got to put into that conversion cost that he would have had for that. So actually you could say he'd spent a lot of money on this property. So it was on for a guide of £100,000. Now, as you can imagine, everybody had done their due diligence and everybody had seen that it was £100,000 vice what he must have been paid for. So I turned up for this viewing and there must have been, it was like coaches turning up, the amount of people there, so like a coach would turn, it was 3 block viewings, a coach would turn up and it would be like 50 odd people would flood off into this building. And I went in, there were builders measuring up, there were people doing full, pacing it out, measuring the rooms, floor plans. And I just walked around and I just thought, I'm not even going to bother because there's too much competition and I don't want to get into that kind of game. So later that week, there was an email went out by William H. Browns. I still remember the agent. William H. Browns sent out an email saying there'd been knotweed discovered in the back garden. Nowadays, knotweed is, I wouldn't say prevalent, certainly in North Yorkshire, those people who invest up in the north, North Yorkshire, northeast, my God, you'll know about knotweed, it's everywhere. But it's a very invasive plant. It grows into the foundations of a building, it can damage a building, it can move buildings, and it's also illegal to cut it down and dispose of it yourself. But nowadays, there's a lot of people who will treat it. I'm talking kind of 5 years ago, oh God, longer than that actually, probably about 8 years ago, actually, if I thought about it. And there wasn't many people who treated... Sorry, Lisa, I know I'm dragging on with your...
No, it's fine.
There was not a lot of people who did it, not me. So, but I then saw a problem. So I thought, hang on a second. This property now is... So I did a bit of research, is technically unmortgageable. There wasn't many people out there who could do knotweed treatments, but there was one that I found in Manchester. And I still remember who it was. It was a company called Weed Tech. There was non-local, simply this one. And I basically went down, burrowing down this rabbit hole of how can I solve this problem? Now, at that time, people used to get rid of knotweed by cutting it off at the stem. And those of you who've seen knotweed, it's kind of a bamboo shoot looking thing. So that you'd cut knotweed off at the stem, you'd fill the stems up with diesel. And that was kind of the known thing to get rid of knotweed, because then you sell the property and then at that point you walk away hands scot-free and it grows in 5 years or 3 years time. But if it's within 10 meters of the boundary, it was unmortgageable. So long story short, this property now was valued at nothing. And I thought, God, you know what? I've just found out a way. This company Weed Tech have told me if they put a treatment plan in place, I can then mortgage it. I spoke to Shawbrook Bank and a broker and they said, yes, you can. And I thought, right, do you know what? I'm gonna throw an offer over the table here. So I offered $112,000 for that property. Thinking, there we are. And why did I throw $112,000? Because $112,000 was all I could muster in cash, because obviously it had to be a cash purchase. So $112,000 was thrown across William H. Brown's desk. There's my offer. And they rang me back up 2 days later saying, yep, you're down to the last few bids, would like to welcome you to best and final. And I thought, bloody hell, there must have been 200 people viewed that property and I'm down to the last few. So I put in a sealed bid offer, 117.5, I think it was 490, some round, 117 anyway is what it ended up being. And I won it. And that was as simple as that. And it was a cash purchase. I bought it cash. The very next day we had Weed Tech come and treat the knotweed. Knotweed was treated and then it was revalued by Shawbrook at £350,000. And that property then is the seven beds that went out to the care leavers. I didn't know who at that time that would go out to. They all needed a complete refurbishment, a heavy, you know, like they were all there as one bed flats, but they all needed new bathrooms, new kitchens, full decor. But the superstructure was there, the split supplies, the major work was done. So I just reconfigured them as nothing fancy, just the same one bed flats, nice decor. And put them out to, as I say, and that's gone to care leavers who are in there at present.
So when you say you put it out to, did you go and try and find someone?
That company was actually brought to me by a local agent.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So even though I had that in my mind, they brought me that local agent. And it was actually a company from the Northwest.
Right.
Who have a national coverage, who were looking for properties in that region. But at that time, I hadn't. It's kind of, I found the problem that we're trying to say solve with Gateway. I wanted to do this more, but I didn't know where to go. Mm. So, you know, the homeless side had always been through the council. Then I'd been introduced to a charity, you know, that link had been always made. Those introductions were made. So even though I now had this property and I thought I want to do that strategy, I didn't know where to go. You know, I didn't know whose door to go knocking on for care leavers. I didn't configure it in that manner. I just bought this property because it was a bargain, quite frankly. And I didn't know where to go. And it was a local agent came to me and said, I have this RP who has been hounding me for this type of property. Would you? And I just thought, there's my link to that provider. And then from then, we've formed a fantastic relationship. Never cut that agent out. That agent, even though they do not manage it at all, still gets paid on a monthly basis. Yeah. But it's one of those things, you know, there's a perfect example. You know, I'd been, I wouldn't say in the industry, but I certainly knew about the exit, you know, because we'll refer to kind of supported living as an exit. I knew about this exit. I knew that it existed, that it was a solid, solid exit, and it was providing these homes for these vulnerable people, and it was something I wanted to do more, but I didn't know where to go. And then all of a sudden it was brought to me. But that, you know, when I think of, you know, the project we're working on at the moment, that's what we're trying to kind of eradicate. We're trying to eradicate those, that situation where a person may have a fantastic development or a fantastic property who wants to help these individuals, but has nowhere to go and doesn't know where to go. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of, you know, that's why you and I and the rest of the team started this whole thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And when you're talking to people, so many people are saying, oh, how do I find out? And so many of the guests I've had on this so far it's been a bit of a chance encounter. I know it was when I started. Yeah. And that's kind of how they've fallen into it
And it's been a chance encounter for me as well. And again, even when I've then tried to develop to order, you know, and that's really the route I want to go down. It becomes so, so difficult. You know, I know you've got a fantastic relationship with your RP where the demand is kind of forecast a wee bit more. but certainly with the one or the ones that I work with, they say there's a, I've just got two cats going mad down beside me here. They say, you know, they've always got this this demand, say, for one bed units, etc. But it's almost an immediate demand. They need them now. And the risk there is if I develop a block of 5, 6, 7, 8 apartments without necessarily having that little bit of a guarantee that they are going to take them, it's a risky thing for myself. So certainly when I try to do that, I'm then left between kind of a rock and a hard place. I've got to kind of decide, right, I want to help them, but they can't guarantee it. So I've got to find somewhere that if they don't take it, we'll still rent to the general public on standard ASTs, or if it's an HMO, that it'll still rent to the rooms. And, you know, I've got a large HMO as well, which is all ensuite rooms, large, quite a relatively large development. And that's now one with a move on provider now as well. So that's a different standard to potentially the one in Selby. This one is higher spec, but still the rooms are kind of sublet, if that makes sense. One charity's taking it all off me. Rooms are then sublet to those individuals who then hopefully will move on to the next accommodation. It's kind of just that juggling act, isn't it? It's I want to help more, but it's a very difficult thing without that kind of guaranteed need, because the need is now, not in 6 months' time.
And that's very much the case, isn't it? So, you know, local authority commissioners are subject to so many different budgetary changes and pressures. They can't say that in 3 years' time they'll definitely need this, because actually they'll have had a change of local elections. Everything will have changed around them. So it's very much that need is now, 3 months' time, not as long.
You know, there's some fantastic things, you know, I do refer back to, you know, I've certainly got a bit of a spread of where I'm helping. As I said, probably the most of mine are with, as I say, this move on, even though I've got others with care leavers and things like that. But with the move on's an interesting one, because when I was working with this charity in Norfolk, the charity's called the Purfleet Trust, if anybody's ever heard of it. It's run by a fantastic lady there who has an absolute passion for ending homelessness, as you would if you were running a homeless charity. And we had a meeting with... and the only reason I ended up working in North Norfolk, quite frankly, and again, I was still in the military at this time. The only reason I started working with her or liaising with her was because she was really trying to be cutting edge in what she was doing. She was engaging, you know, on a government level. She was engaging Homes England. She was engaging the local housing associations to get everybody around one table. And actually, she did an absolutely amazing job of doing that, because then everybody was around one table. And I was then invited in along with two others who went in as kind of the developers, shall we say, to try and fill this need. But because the amount of red tape was phenomenal, and I ended up stepping aside from that one.
Was looking at a very local strategy. Was this in Norfolk, or was this a bigger thing?
Well, it was local, but we had in the South East representative from Homes England, who spoke heavily of the budget, or the budgets which were available for both capital and revenue funding. They spoke about their passion for ending homelessness. They spoke about their passion to bring in faster development, so use of modular, etc., to do this. And it was a fascinating conversation to have, but none of it solved the now need. And I felt that the need, people, the homelessness, weren't projecting far enough ahead, and all the developers, the councils, the housing associations weren't looking far enough back. And actually, I was sat there thinking, we're at a stalemate here, because we're not projecting the need far enough. Now, the need's probably going to be exactly the same, if not worse, than it is now. Okay. Mm. But, and again, you've got to think about it at the time. I was still in the full-time job, so I was trying to commit as much as I could to this, but then I was pulled away every now and then, and left the other two chaps. There's two other chaps who are still heavily working on this with that region. But the takeaway lessons for that is, or were that effectively the Homes England piece, fascinating, fantastic, a lot of red tape. Okay, so what do we need to do? I think the more people who are becoming engaged in this strategy, the more people who are helping at the local level will ultimately start impacting on a national level, which is what needs to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And responding to that need.
And I think, you know, we're in a situation now where we've just housed every homeless person. So what, you know, because of COVID-19, now I know there's a lot of controversy about that, but what that said is, it's possible what was the thing that changed? Obviously, yes, a pandemic, but also budgets. So it was as if almost this bag of money was opened up. So all of a sudden now, instead of trying to rehouse those, which I know a lot of the councils are, I know a lot of the councils are just putting people back on the streets, okay? And I know they have done that here because I'm getting calls. I've had a call today. Did I have any room in my property? Actually, we need to completely look at this and say, yes, we haven't got this open, this pot of money that we can house people in hotels, bed and breakfast, etc. But, okay, we've now got to do something about it because we're taking somebody who's off the street, putting them back on the street. So let's see what we can do there. But as I say, there's 1,001 support living sectors. That's just the one that has in the past resonated a lot with me because of the work. And as I say, and certainly with the veteran side as well, I always have a keen ear on the ground.
Do you want to talk a bit more about the veteran side of it, Rich?
Yeah, so the veteran side, I've got a, it was one of those burning desires, which I haven't, it's an itch that I haven't scratched and I will at some time because I can't scratch every itch, shall we say. And I feel that what I'm doing now is helping, and this is something when I've built, it's kind of, think of it as an analogy of, you know, if I chase, go and scratch that itch now, actually, yes, I could probably do it on a small scale, but actually if I work on the bigger picture now and work on the supported living gateway that we're doing and the bit that I'm doing with Blue Oak and a few other pieces, actually, if I just pause that for 5 years, I can help on a far bigger scale. And the thing with the veterans is, you know, I had two individuals who worked for me when I was in Afghanistan. So I was pretty much toing and froing from Afghanistan from 2017. God, I was there pretty much twice a year. So we used to do shorter stints than the 6 month tours. We used to do 3 to 4 months. But what that meant is we'd do 4 months in theater, 4 months in Afghanistan flying, 2 months at home, 4 months Afghanistan, 2 months at home. And it became a relentless cycle. And it broke people. It absolutely broke people. And I had two individuals who worked with me, powerful, powerful men, you know, real professional, exceptional at what they did. And we came back. Our squadron was then stood down from Afghanistan. And I saw two individual men become shadows of themselves. They had issues at home. And again, in the military, we generally would live in accommodation which is provided for us, married quarter accommodation, or if you're single you'll have what's called block accommodation, but it's paid for, so therefore your pay, you know, and it's in the military, you know, it's a very much a kind of a social drinking culture, and it was known as Millionaire's Day. On the first of every month you were paid, okay, you had no outgoings, so it was pretty much to all of these single people or with families, it was disposable income. Now of course what happens is all of a sudden, something happens like that. They had an upset in their relationship and they were out of their married quarters and they were in essence homeless. They'd gone from nothing to homeless with no provisions, no backup, no savings, because the attitude at that time, it's changed significantly now, but the attitude at that time was, it was a very, you know, social drinking culture. People did used to work hard, play hard, the classic thing. And, you know, that coupled with relentless tours of Afghanistan, you know, I'm not saying it was PTSD was in there, but PTSD plays a hell of a role. And it really is heavy, heavy burden on your head. And these two absolutely powerful men were homeless. And I looked at that, I was like, how is that possible? And I couldn't get my head around it. I was baffled and I could not get my head around it. So ever since, and I look at that and I think, do you know what? As a military man, I can talk to them. I understand their situation. And I had a vision and a passion at the time to, and again, a lot of these people are skilled. You know, they're passionate workers. Their work ethic is unquestionable. And a lot of them all have manual labor trades. They may be plumbers. They may be electricians. They may be whatever. You know, they've got manual trades. Mm-hmm. And I had this vision of, right, do you know what? We can potentially put something together here. I was going to call it Homes Fit for Heroes with an old friend of mine. Homes Fit for Heroes was where the name kind of started. Put a group of these people together in a property that they can work on together. They can build that camaraderie. They can actually, you know, you almost have the sergeant major of the house. So you have that sergeant major figure who leads that house. And they're proud of what they do, because that's generally with veterans what, when they are homeless, what is stripped away from them is their pride. So actually, if I could put them in a situation where there's pride again, it enables them to get back on their feet. And it needs somebody kind of from a military background to do that. And that's why I thought, you know what, I could, if hopefully in time, put a team of ex-servicemen together who have the similar passion to myself to potentially work in this industry. And I know there's a lot of people doing it now, and it's fascinating, brilliant. And you know, if I can help them, work with them, then I would love to. If I can,
I know actually there's a scheme in Plymouth that's doing a very similar.
Yeah. And again, it's those military towns are doing some brilliant things because it's so bad, because the problem is so ridiculous. And again, just feel, I feel, you know, at least we're out of Afghanistan now. As a British government, we're not fighting as much as we were, but I do still think it's a little bit of a ticking time bomb, the PTSD issue with ex-servicemen. So that's my passion with veterans. And it's the, you know, it's because I've seen people at such the pinnacle, pinnacle of what they are capable of, go from there to the bottom, kind of without even passing go. And yeah. It's because they've been kind of institutionalized, been in this bubble of the military. And don't get me wrong, I loved being in that bubble, but I can also see exactly how it can go wrong so quickly.
Mm. That transition from being very protected, like you're saying, in that bubble, you know, to the real life stuff that suddenly gets thrown at you.
And again, it comes back down to, I talk a lot whenever I do my kind of lives on Blue Oak, that if people spend a little bit more time, a lot of people think of the minority. So you or we are in a minority. When we are property investors, we're in a minority. We understand the need for, you know, protecting our income, protect, you know, investments, you know, the difference between an asset and a liability. We are a minority. If you put your head into the majority, okay, the majority of people, and that's why I actually think the country's in for a bit of a shock with the furlough scheme. The majority of people think slightly differently. So the majority of the military, when I was in there, got paid on the first of the month, went out the second, third, and fourth of the month, and then were broke by the fifth of the month. Yeah. They didn't have responsibilities of paying council tax because it was paid for in either their married quarters or their block. They didn't have to worry about paying the bills because it came out at source. So that those kind of basic living things could easily go missed. And so I put my head into the majority. So I sort of think, and I do it in everything I do now, I'll think about the majority. What would let's not think how I think when it comes to property investing or investing or whatever. Let's think how everybody else would think. And let's see if we can help them. So what I'm getting at there is, you know, with the military person, a little bit of education goes a long way. You are in this bubble without ever kind of needing to see the outside world. And that's part of what I'm doing now. Potentially, I'm not the housing the veterans at the front end, but I'm very passionate and keen to get the education of property and property investing into, you know, the resettlement centers of the military, the people who are leaving, those people, because again, these guys have a lot of disposable income that they can put to good use to protect themselves for the rest of their lives, rather than there's the, boof, there's the axe, and now all of a sudden you might end up as another homeless statistic.
Mm. Yeah. Absolutely. Guys, don't forget to ask any questions if you've got any for Rich. We'll get to some in a minute. So the different properties you've got your homeless one with the shared accommodation with the three flats beneath it, which is being used for that initial homeless. You've got your move on one, which is a slightly later stage for the...
So I've got the three at the moment. So I've got that's 3 plus 7. So the three flats and the seven. Yeah. I've got the seven flats, which are for the kind of the care leavers. Yeah. And then I have a 14 bed HMO, which is now up in, so that's split as a ground floor, 4-bed unit, and then 10 beds over the next two floors. They've segregated the ground floors now women only. So that's, like kind of a female floor, lockable door there. That's a female floor.
And this is the transition from homeless.
They're a bit further on. So they're kind of holding their own tenancies.
Okay.
So again, it's, to be honest, the East Riding and the North Yorkshire councils have come to, they have a really, really, not that I, if I'm honest, I don't know any other local authorities' plans, but I look at it and I think from when I first started doing that sector in 2007, where it was kind of a bit of the Wild West nomad land of property investing, which was quite interesting. You know, HMOs were regularly with, you know, two bedrooms, but 75 tenants. It was, this seemed to have a good plan in place, which is very, very good. So that's 14. That's gone through all sorts of cycles, that property, if I'm honest. When I first did it, that went on a contract to contractors at Siemens.
Right.
So Siemens on that coal stairs, the Centre for Renewable Energies, building wind turbines. They moved out of that. I renewed a contract with another contractor firm, and then this RP came and took that property off me for what they are using it for now.
And is that someone again that you went to find, that registered provider? How did that come about, that relationship with them?
Was one of those. It kind of came through a mutual contact. By this point, you know, this came through social media, reached out to me. We met, had that conversation, but it was kind of a, they asked at the right time. The contract was coming to an end with a company was called Harris Pye, who were in there at the time. The contract was coming to an end with them, and I then, coming to an end in a couple of months' time, and I set about negotiating with them. So they're all up, got kind of enhanced rates in there. So they, you know, my rent is very good, but it's also fantastic what they're doing with that property. But that's a 14 bed, very large rooms, all en suite, really, you know, high spec, and it shows kind of what they're. Again, it comes back down to, you know, that piece I said at the beginning with regard to, you know, physical health, standard of accommodation, and then the therapy. Piece as well. So actually what they've got there is a good standard of accommodation which has a direct impact on their health, and lo and behold, good standard of accommodation, they all keep it in a very good condition, they take pride in it, and it's directly impact their health. So the times that I still go and have a walk around that property, do you know what, everyone's fantastic. Don't get me wrong, everybody bloody smokes, nobody smokes in the building, but I'm not going to set out on a vendetta to stop people smoking. But as far as their health goes, they're in a far, far better place than potentially, or they are taking pride. The care that the RP are putting in place for them is fantastic, and part of that is, as I say, focused on health, focused on, they do a lot of speech therapy, which is quite interesting, which I've spoke to them quite a lot about as well. And a lot of that's just about being able to relay those emotions, those in the past potentially they've been in conflicting situations. So again, it's just There's obviously been some work done on that, but a lot of that's to do with speech and behavioural therapy as well, which is all part of care.
Yeah. And unfortunately, something's just not been funded enough, speech therapy.
No.
All sectors. We've got a few interesting questions, Rich. I don't know if you're all right to attack some of these.
Yeah. Interesting questions, always like that. Why do you never see baby pigeons is one of the most interesting ones I know. Yeah.
Sean Malone saying, very interesting. I do some fostering and supported lodgings for young adults leaving care. I did a talk recently to the local council, and level 4 foster care is about care leavers and their life prospects. Lots was promised after this presentation, but nothing came from it. I'll be interested in doing more, so great to listen to this. I'd be very interested in talking with you. Also, I'm ex-forces. Oh, there you go. It's not so much a question, but more sort of validation of what you've been saying.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that is, I think a lot of that's quite interesting, because I think the local authorities do put on a lot of these presentations, as such, you know, and don't get me wrong, like I've said, here where I am, they have been fantastic, but you do seem to, on that frontline piece, seem to think there's nothing happening. But actually, having been in some of the meetings further up and seen the levels of red tape, I understand it looks like nothing's happening, but potentially it is, but it might be stalled at some point. So sometimes it's just a case of a little bit of patience, a little bit of a follow-up, a little bit of a chase. I wouldn't say they're not necessarily doing anything. I'd say potentially it's stalled at some point, and maybe they're just waiting to get it through. So on that point, you know, if you want to do reach out to me, you know, on Facebook, drop me a message. Certainly if you're ex-force, you know, I'm always happy to have a chinwag with anybody. But don't lose faith. And I see that a lot with people who are looking for an RP or they've got this passion to help. And I understand the difficulty getting in front of these people to get your property recognized, or onto the, from a properties investor angle, you want to help. One, you want to help those individuals, so you're trying to help those physical tenants, but also you're trying to, you know, have that true passive income, which is why a lot of us got into property investing in the first place. And I see a lot of people, you know, stumbling at that front door. You know, they get a no, they get a rejection, say from the first RP, and quite often they'll give up. it is one of those kind of strategies, one of those exits where you do need to keep persisting, keep moving, keep talking to them, keep building those engagements. It's a classic bit of, you know, they always say property is a people business. You know, this in particular is a people business. This sector, this strategy, it's a people business. You must build those relationships.
Yeah, and it can take a long time, like you say, and people are tied up in all kinds of stuff. Darren Burrows is saying they've only actually housed 15,000 out of 35,000 street homeless since the break of COVID. I've heard different numbers batted around, and I think different areas are doing it better than others. But I think
I know Darren's doing some fantastic work in that sector and has done. You know, so I'm sure he has some fantastic stats on that. I do know where I am. They did really, really well. I wouldn't like to say they did everybody, but I know they did very, very well. I know what he's saying there's about 50%. And I know he's operating day in, day out in that sector and doing some fantastic work. So,
Sarah's saying it's a national scandal. I'm not sure whether it's to do with the homeless bit or the veterans bit, but I think both bits could be applied to, really. Jason Petch is saying, have you been involved with the Veterans Village in Hull and East Riding, and how much impact do you feel this will make for homeless veterans? I don't know if
it's being built at the moment. I haven't had much of a involvement in it. I know where it is. On paper, it seems fantastic. Okay, it's one of those things that it's kind of a local authority driven piece, and they are doing. It seems if it does what it says on the tin, it will be absolutely fantastic. And it's one of those things, though, it has had criticism. And again, this is something that really bothers me in a way. So it's had criticism locally about how it doesn't even scratch the surface. They should be doing more, that sort of thing. But the bottom line is, let's just, instead of being negative about that, let's be positive and say, right, well, at least we are scratching the surface, okay? And we are doing something. And this isn't at all by the chap who asked that question now, you know, but I'm just saying that there has been, I've heard rumblings locally of people saying, oh, well, they should be doing twice that. But, you know, this is a waste of money. They should be doing twice that. If they're not going to do it three times the size, then why waste the money? But the bottom line, instead of being negative about that, be positive. They're doing something. Any little thing is better than nothing. And that, I feel, for veterans, will get them back on their feet. That sort of thing, where it's very much like what I said, where you're putting veterans together to build the camaraderie. If you put veterans with veterans, they will get back on their feet far, far quicker than if you put a veteran with another bunch of ex-homeless, because they don't share that same ethos. If you put five veterans in a room, never met each other before at all, they will be having banter, fun, conversation in like that, okay? Because everybody's got shared experiences. You've all been through a basic kind of military training. If you put a veteran with four other people of similar ilk, that camaraderie will not be there. So what I'm getting at is this village may be small or maybe not big enough for what some people are saying should be, but what it will enable people to do is get back on their feet quicker. Put them in there, put them with the veterans, they will recover, they will get back on their feet far, far quicker, and then move on. And at that point, that cycle of people coming in can speed up. Yeah.
Sean's asking, I think the Gateway is a fantastic initiative. Which areas of the country will it cover? And will it work for single, smaller properties or just blocks of self-contained units?
Yeah. So, Sean, obviously, the intent with Gateway is that it'll be national. Okay, so we are working at the moment to try and cover. The team members of Gateway are kind of geographically spread in four corners, with Lisa being a little bit further down on this leg than potentially the square, shall we say. But you know, we're separated with kind of northeast region, northwest, southeast, and then Lisa down in the southwest. The intention is that it will be national. Now we are looking at the whole sector of RPs, whole sector of housing associations across the whole country. Now, as you, I'm sure, well know, there are thousands and thousands. There will always be potential gaps within our overlap, but we are building this now. We are testing it. We hope to go live, you know, within about a 12 to 16 week point. But those of you who sign up to the newsletter, we will keep you updated on that. And I'll drop the link in for the newsletter for the Gateway in a moment. But the point, the plan is to go national, okay? Because we really want to solve that problem. We really want to provide a solution for the developer who has a passion, to either just get his property on as a on some form of hands-off basis, and to help the vulnerable. Because ultimately, if we can all help in a small manner, then collectively we're helping in a big manner. And then also the RPs on the right-hand side. If we can provide a platform where they can look at suitable properties that have been vetted already, that have been quality checked, which we aim to put systems in place to do that, to ensure that the correct quality of properties are there. If that RP can have a look on our platform and find the correct quality product that can then be married up into a lease to save time, effort, and actually speed up this whole process, then as a gateway, you know, as a supported living gateway, we will have succeeded. And that's really our aim. It will start small. We're not going to be a national straight away, but give us time. We've got huge aspirations for this. We've got a massively powerful team in place. And I think if anybody can make it happen, we can.
And as for the single smaller properties or just blocks.
Sorry, I forgot that end there. I mean, that is your bag. You love a little small bungalow.
I'm going to get names for myself in my bungalow. Yeah. But yeah, absolutely everything. You know, the demand is there for small detached properties all the way up to blocks, large blocks of flats. Absolutely.
I think, Sean, what the intent will be, you know, when we look at that, and again, where I sometimes see this falling down is, say, you've got a small two-bed property or a bungalow, whatever that may be. And that may be a very niche thing. It may be a very niche property, which may appeal to some RPs, but not necessarily others. Now, if you get that wrong, so the RP hasn't got a geographical coverage where yours is, we may miss that coverage, and that property may never actually be able to help or get onto a lease. But the idea being, there may be another smaller RP who nobody's ever heard of, or you haven't heard of, or whatever, that may cover that area. And a lot of this is getting missed at the moment. A lot of this is falling between the cracks. And the idea, again, Gateway, put these properties on there, get as many RPs on there as possible, which with national coverage, that will allow that property to be seen, hopefully by an RP which has that coverage. So the answer is yes, there is a demand for it. And yes, in time, with a national coverage, we hope to be able to facilitate all property types.
Tim Hamlet's asking, how do you find these specialist local charities? Where do you find their details to be able to contact them to discuss their housing requirements? My local RP will only lease an HMO if it's got 12 plus rooms.
Wow, 12 plus rooms.
Most of the ones I know won't touch anything that big.
Yeah, 100%. They, you know, more want something far, far smaller because it's more manageable. And where's a good starting point? You know, there is, you know, quite... Obviously, that is why we're trying to do this, quite frankly, because we've seen this problem. And that's where we're going with this. So, you know, please do give us a little bit of time. Let's get this off the ground, and hopefully we will be able to help there. Mm. Have a little look on, you know, there is the National Register of all RPs and charities. It's open source information. If you type it into Google, you know, list of current RPs, it will give you that list. And they are separated by geographical region, and you can have a little look down there. It hasn't got contact details. It doesn't tell you anything, but then you're into that little bit of CSI work where you're going to have to do the investigation yourself.
I think also, Rich, so if you're looking for the small local charities, it's about networking locally, isn't it? It's getting to know people, asking around, finding out what the need is.
Council should have a housing options department. Again, it's always, you know, so the two ladies who work in the housing options department where I am, fantastic. Font of knowledge, been there for years. Ask around. It is, as Lisa said, it's networking. Ask around. Ask in there. They may be able to point you in the right direction. But it's not easy. And hence, we've seen that it's not easy, and we're trying to provide something. We've seen the need. We're trying to provide something to satisfy that need.
Natalie's asking, is financing a property with this strategy difficult? Thanks for the excellent session.
Let's say the pool of lenders is narrower. Okay, yeah. So the pool of lenders is narrower. It is possible, however, and I think that's the crux of it. Okay, it is a barrier. It is a hurdle, but it's not a hurdle that can't be got over. So the pool of lenders is narrower, but there are still brokers out there. There's still enough lenders to lend on this strategy of property. Okay.
It might be worth just going back, and there was an interview a couple of weeks ago with Dean and Craig, who are brokers, specialist brokers in this area. So it might be worth grabbing that one if it's something you're interested in catching that. Is your plan to map RPs across the UK?
Yeah.
Are there standards?
And that is it. We want to cover the whole country in time. And as I say, don't, you know,
we're speaking to a lot of national RPs, aren't we? You
know, so. Yeah, and I think that's, again, what people miss. Some people, you know, so for instance, the one I worked with, you know, in my region, their head office is in the northwest of the UK, and they have a national coverage. Now, when we first met, I didn't know they had a national coverage. But of course, once you start digging, you realise that they have national coverage. So, you know, our initial plan will be to find more of the national coverage RPs. And then as we start to add those to the system and get them on board, we will start to filter down into the smaller providers, the housing, or then into the housing. So the whole block from the housing associations, the RPs, etc. The intent and the plan, the goal, the aim, whatever you want to say, is to have that national coverage.
Anil's asking, are there standard specs for supported living accommodation?
Yeah, and that's really another arm of this that we are aiming to do. So with this platform, we aim to be able to kind of vet the properties, to find out what they want, what spec they want, what standard they want. Is it anything special? Is it wider doorways? Is it lifts? Whatever that may be. And again, it varies completely from your bungalow accommodation, so single story accommodation, to somewhere where they want multiple units. There is a spec. Now we aim to get that spec, and we aim to, the properties that come to us, we will be able to vet to ensure that what goes onto the platform is of a suitable standard.
I think it's also about being very, very tenant focused, isn't it? About needs led, depending on which group you're working with and what exactly the needs are.
What we don't want to do is have we want individuals to have, you know, we're looking for the highest standard property, because ultimately the higher the standard, like I came back to, you know, revert back. I know I was talking about the homeless sector side there, but it's across the entire supported side that actually, if health can be improved and the standard of accommodation can be improved, because again, there's a lot of substandard accommodation in the supported living sector. So if we can improve the standard of accommodation by only providing properties on our platform that have had a vet check, that we ensure are to a very good, livable, human standards, shall we say, then actually what we're doing on the right-hand side, we're ensuring that these people who require the properties are getting the best possible accommodation. So one of our biggest challenges is this middle piece of vetting the properties, how we will do that. You know, we'll have process flows. We've got a team member who loves a process flow. Okay. You know, we'll have process flows of how we will do that, of how we will vet them to ensure that those high standards are there. We won't just be accepting anything on there, because if we accept anything on there, what we will get are the landlords who've got empty properties throwing properties on the gateway. And you've then got to go back to source on that one, and you've got to say, well, why are the properties empty? Quite frankly, they're probably because they're at substandard.
Although they're not in the right location, they're not exactly what needs. Yeah. So, you know, there's a massive different thing. It actually, Jitesh is asking, does the Gateway program assist with getting RP engagement? He's got a current situation with the property he's trying to place with an RP.
Yes.
Unfortunately, it doesn't always match, does it? You know, it is trying
I think that's exactly it. You know, and, you know, I'm very familiar with Jit's property there. And again, it's the area. It's one of those things that's a perfect example of, we know the area. Right now, we haven't got a coverage of that area for that property type. The intent will be, in time, you know, if we draw a circles across the UK, okay, there are always going to be holes in the where these circles overlap. In time, we hope to get enough coverage to cover nationally. I'm very aware of his property, and, you know, we have looked into that one, but it's proving far, far more difficult than initially anticipated.
Have you access? Oh, where do you sign up for the newsletter? The Gateway newsletter. We'll drop it into the comments in a bit, Jackie. Scott's asking, have you got any access to grants to help reduce the cost of development? It's a very specialist area, the grants thing. There are capital grants, aren't the rich, that are available, but they generally have to be applied for by the RPs or someone on your behalf. It's something Sarah Walker's a bit of a whiz at.
And again, you know, a long time ago, I've read a lot about the Homes England one. We've read the paper on Homes England. They have a thing called the Move On Fund. I think it expired this year, but they've brought in another one to replace it. It's worth reading their papers on that, okay, about about if your property is suitable for that. Again, that's very much into move-on accommodation only and not necessarily some of the other areas of supported living. That's move-on accommodation, but there is a pool or a pot of money for both capital and revenue funding there, which is an interesting one. But it is a very, very specialist area. Again, hopefully in time, you know, one of phase two, shall we say, of the Gateway will be able to provide other avenues of that education piece, the grants available in whatever area, and again, other other affiliates with regards to specialists in this field. So that's the plan for that. But yes, there are grants available, very, very specialist and locally kind of focused.
There are also, if you're doing a property, a very specialised property for a named individual, you can apply for disabled facilities grant. But again, that has to be gone through by the local care team, have to apply for it on the named individual's behalf. Yeah. I've done that before for very specialist adaptations in a property, but it does take a bit of time. Mm-hmm. There can be 18-month delays in accessing them for some areas. We're getting there. There's a lot of questions here. Philip Norton's asking, government-backed RPs are potentially more reliable than charities because they can lose their funding and that can be challenging for the owners and developers. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's why charities often offer you shorter leases, you know, and that would be the right thing for them to do for their financial.
One of the biggest things for me, and that's 100%, is it's again from the property angle as well, you know, from the property investor angle. Yes, we've got to look at this and we've got to look at the world we're coming into. You know, this is as close to, yes, you've got some smaller charities who may lose their funding. You've got potentially, you know, some other avenues of challenges. But as if we're looking for as recession proof as we could possibly get, this sector is fantastic. And again, that's part of, you know, for me, that's another string to that bow. You know, we're helping the vulnerable, but we're also, if we're not profitable, if we are not making money ourselves as investors, then we're never going to be able to help. Okay, so actually we've got to be able to, yes, no matter how much we want to help, we've still got to make money, otherwise that help will deteriorate and it will be there. And I think this sector and this you know, looking at the charities and the government RPs, etc., is as recession proof as we can possibly get. And nobody can deny, well, we are going into a recession. For me, it's not a question of how deep, it's more of how deep and how long, I will it get to a depression. Mm-hmm. That's what it is for me. It's going to be a challenging time for property investors, but also a great opportunity to potentially be able to invest harder, heavier, and be able to develop properties, you know, if you've prepared well, to then be able to help this. So we're going to have a period where hopefully you'll be able to buy properties at, shall we say, significant discounts. And hopefully by that point, we'll have the Gateway up and running. So let's marry those two together. Let's create some fusion and let's try and help everybody.
You ready? Are you right for another one or two? You're right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. Philip Norton's also asking, Rich, does having a 5+ year lease, government-backed RP lease, increase the commercial value of the property as a whole? I'm thinking exit strategy.
Yeah, something we talk about a lot. Yeah, so 100%. You know, it depends on the covenant, the strength of that lease. Mm-hmm. So it depends on who's physically written that lease. Okay, it's not a charity or an organization that's been around for just a year. Okay, but if the covenant strength of that lease 100%, then get a commercial valuation on that. The two brokers that Lisa mentioned just now will be able to advise you far better on that. But in essence, you know, you could look for a multiplier, and we spoke to them recently, and the multiplier can be potentially even up to 12. So what that's saying is gross
rent, isn't it? Yeah.
12. But I was shocked when they said, if you took 10, for instance, you know, so there's some areas where that works fantastically well. So it's the gross rent multiplied by that factor. Sometimes the bricks and mortar is more, okay, but sometimes the commercial valuation is more the factor multiplied by that gross rent. But to answer the question, yes, a lease of that length, as long as the covenant strength of that lease is good, then yes, would improve that commercial valuation and for your exit.
Yeah, yeah. Last one, Paul Reed, what determines the areas to look for in this sector to understand the demand side?
Yeah, to be honest, you could pretty much say the demand is national. The demand is absolutely national. The question is finding the individual organisations, charities, RPs who cover that region. But in essence, wherever you are, whatever town, whatever city you're in, there will be a demand. It's just finding who manages that demand in that region. And that is the biggest stumbling block. And it's that stumbling block that we do hope to kind of rectify with what we're doing, because the demand is there. And that's kind of the sad thing, is the demand is there. All of these RPs and these charities are crying out for the correct properties. They are in desperate need, but they struggle to find the properties equally as much as you struggle to get the properties with those RPs. So there's a struggle from both sides. And it's kind of ludicrous when you think about it, that they can't be married up. And that's, as I say, that's what we're trying to do. So to answer your question, the demand is everywhere. It's just physically finding who manages that demand in that region. Which RP manages it, which charity manages, which housing association covers it, who covers your region. But the demand is most certainly there.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys. Thank you ever so much for watching. We've had lots of people watching, loads of great comments. And thank you ever so much, Rich. It's been really, really valuable. right. Thank you. Good night.